Welcome to Guerrilla Radio. Well, after a year and a month of bloody conflict at the barriers separating Gaza from the world, the Great Return March continues yet. Every Friday, Palestinians demanding an end to their dispossession and forced isolation have faced Israel's military, for the most part peaceably, and suffered mightily for it. And though hundreds have been killed, shot down, barehanded by soldiers with sniper rifles, and thousands more gassed and wounded in other ways, the international community of nations has largely remained silent. The run-up to Israel's recent elections occasioned harder lines on the Palestine problem in Gaza by politicians on all sides, while one prominent among them even promised, should he be elected, he would too annex the settlements, bringing a Gaza of sorts to the West Bank. Dr. Susan Power is head of the Legal Research and Advocacy Department at Al-Haq, a Palestinian human rights NGO based in Ramallah. Established in 1979, Al-Haq's mission is to protect human rights and promote the rule of law in the occupied territories, both individually and collectively, while seeking to end breaches of international law irrespective of the identity of the perpetrator. Susan Power in the first half. And April 11th, a date that will for many live in infamy, Ecuador's President Lenin Moreno delivered from its embassy in London into the hands of the British government political asylee and WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange. Miles of newsprint and terabytes of misinformation has been produced regarding Assange and the nature of the case manufactured against him, but at its heart are some basic facts vital for both his just treatment and the future fairness of the planet the rest of us will inhabit. Dr. Maximilian C. Forte is a scholar, educator, author, and creator of the Zero Anthropology Project, a Canadian anthropological approach to the study of empire and the human condition. Max Forte and Untying the Media Tangle to find a coherent explanation of what the Assange arrest says about the state of the empire and fate of democracy in the second half. And Victoria-based activist and longtime Guerrilla Radio contributor Janine Bancroft will be here at the bottom of the hour with the Left Coast Events Bulletin of some of the good things to be gotten up to in and around our town in the coming week. But first, Susan Power and Palestine's prospects in an extended Netanyahu era. Stick around. Welcome to the program, Susan.
Oh, hello, Chris. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, and I'm very pleased that we're still connected. Susan, you're all the way there in Ramallah today. During the election, candidate Netanyahu said of the West Bank, quote, "From my perspective, any point of settlement in Israel, and I will not transfer, from my perspective, any point of settlement is Israel, rather, and I will not transfer sovereignty to the Palestinians." Susan, if the Prime Minister-elect is to be taken at his word, what does that mean in terms of both international law and life for Palestinians in the West Bank?
This is just a really unprecedented turn of events. I mean, we've been talking about like the possibility of a de facto annexation for a while, and what we're seeing here now is really a threat to de jure annex all the West Bank settlements, and this is following on from the actions last month by the US in recognizing the Golan, the occupied Syrian Golan, as part of the territory of Israel. And at that time, a couple of days before that happened, the US State Department had changed its description of the Golan Heights from Israeli occupied to Israeli controlled, and we've seen similar kinds of changes in language in relation to the West Bank as well. So we're seeing the changes in the terminology of occupation and the terminology of occupation being dropped, both in relation to the Golan and the West Bank at the same time. So really we're seeing a pattern here where we're expecting soon for the settlements in the West Bank to be annexed de jure to Israel. And this is absolutely illegal under international law. UN Resolution 2334 prohibits and acknowledges that the settlements are illegal and are illegal under international law. The whole regime is illegal in terms of the appropriation of property from Palestinians has been carried out in violation of international humanitarian law. The Palestinian population has been forcibly displaced and transferred from their land, which is on continuing violations of Article 49 of the 14th Convention. And then we have the transfer in of the Israeli settler population, again, another war crime under the Article 49 of the 4th Geneva Convention, a violation of the Convention, and also a grave breach and a war crime under the Rome Statute. And then we have continuing destruction of property. But this is part of a broader, this is part of the broader plan of the ethnic cleansing of the whole of mandatory Palestine, the whole of what we would say was mandatory Palestine prior to 1948. To date, about 66% of the lands of mandatory Palestine Palestinians have been forcibly displaced from. There's nearly 5.5 million Palestinian refugees living in states outside of Palestine, in Jordan, Syria, for example, and in a number of other countries around the region and in the broader diaspora again. And we have another nearly 2 million people in Gaza, and about 70% of them are refugees from these displacements as well. And this is an ongoing land grab by Israel to take more and more land, to colonize and continue colonizing the Palestinian territory, to forcibly displace Palestinians from their land, replace them with Israeli Jewish settlers who are brought in from Israel and all over the world, people who are given, who are allocated and given Israeli citizenship, and transferred into the settlements to colonize the territory. And the annexation is the last point in this land grab, to finally bring those territory and lands under the sovereignty of Israel. Well, and after the settlements are taken in, it will go further and further again, and eventually the whole of the West Bank will be appropriated, and it will be also annexed later on as well. This is all part of the final plan. And it's been carried out under the watch of the international community, who have absolutely failed at every single point to intervene and to stop this from happening. This didn't happen last week. We're having the threats of annexation last week. And this has been going on since 1948, and the second wave in 1967 with the occupation, and it is continuing. And it's because of the failure of the international community to intervene, especially over the last 52 years, that we've reached this point. Well, and we saw that dramatically as well with the Golan Heights.
Well, I saw last night, Susan, a report from Israel that said to the effect that the right-wing coalition that Netanyahu has cobbled together following the recent elections have promised him amnesty, or at least have promised him immunity, rather, from prosecution if he should promise carry forward his promise to annex the West Bank. Is this the case, and what do we know more about that?
I think these are very dangerous developments on the ground in terms of impunity for people who are effectively war criminals. So we have a number of violations and war crimes being carried out in the occupied territories, which we already described: the appropriation of property, forceful transfer in, willful killing of people. All of this is carried out at a state level. And it's the people who are ordering these violations of international law. These people are the war criminals. And these people are politicians, high-ranking politicians, high-level people in the Israeli military. And there are already a number of communications which Palestinian civil society, including Al-Haq, have submitted to the International Criminal Court for preliminary examination. And the International Criminal Court is currently in the third phase of this preliminary examination, so I'm going into probably the fourth phase soon. So we're nearly at the final phase, where we're just about to be opening an investigation. And we really have submitted all our materials in documenting all these different war crimes, identifying perpetrators since 2014. Well, what we had a couple of days ago with the situation in Afghanistan, a separate situation, was the International Criminal Court and the pre-trial chamber of the International Criminal Court torpedoing a similar investigation into Afghanistan, which would have investigated U.S. troops, and stating that they were pulling this investigation on the basis of the provision called the interests of justice. And it was basically a politicized decision coming from the threat of the U.S. And afterwards, I think it was quite telling that Donald Trump immediately, the White House immediately issued a statement applauding the decision as being compliant with international law, but also saying that they would do everything to prevent the U.S. and U.S. allies, including Israel, from appearing before the International Criminal Court. And this follows a long line of pretty much bullying of the staff in the International Criminal Court, the prosecutor, judges, who are all threatened to have visas revoked to travel to the United States, and also threats to pull finances, and not just the judges of the International Criminal Court, also all other organizations who are cooperating with the court. So, for example, organizations like Al-Haq, where I work for, and all different human rights organizations would be targeted by punitive measures by the United States. So this is a massive chilling effect. And these are promises coming from the highest level of the U.S. To protect both the U.S. soldiers and Israel. And that's and Israel is stated again and again in all the statements coming out from the U.S. And these are very dangerous precedents. And what we saw on the 12th of April, just gone, was the International Criminal Court buckling to these threats and pulling the investigation in Afghanistan. And we absolutely cannot see the same thing happen for Palestine. We have for 52 years now seen complete impunity in relation to Palestine. There is no justice here. We have carpet bombing of the Gaza Strip periodically. We've had since 2018 at the Great Return March, civilians in five different areas around the Gaza Strip gathering every Friday in peaceful protest and agitating for their right of return as refugees to their homeland from where they're from and for the right to self-determination. And these protests are widely attended. There's thousands of people who attend these every week. And the people who protest are shot down in cold blood. They are targeted and killed by Israeli soldiers who are perched up on a berm along the border area. And they are targeted and willfully killed by these soldiers. And this happens week after week after week. And so far, like since 2018, we've had 204 innocent Palestinians who've been killed in the Great Return March. And it's incidents like this that we need to see coming before the International Criminal Court. And we've also had 29,000 Palestinians in Gaza who are injured just in the last year at the Great Return March. So the system it's come to an absolute halt, like the health system there, from the injuries and the maimings and the complex surgeries that are needed. The situation is horrific. And we're talking about 2 million people who were locked into the Gaza Strip under military siege, where there's very little humanitarian goods coming in and out. Out of all these injuries, even over the last year, and many of these are, there's multiple injuries requiring complex surgeries. And of all these people who've been injured, only 18% of these injuries have been given medical permits to leave the Gaza Strip for treatment. So the situation is absolutely dire. And the people who are responsible for it and who are responsible for these continuing war crimes and continuing crimes against humanity, these people need to be held to account. Yeah. These are very serious, grave breaches of international law. And the international community has a responsibility, an erga omnes responsibility on all states to ensure that these Israeli perpetrators are brought to justice at the International Criminal Court. We need to see massive pressure by all European states and other states, including Canada, to ensure that the International Criminal Court is able to withstand these kinds of attacks by the United States and Israel in trying to deliberately torpedo the competence of the court to carry out its work. And the court must feel supported by other states. And this must mean a support in terms of giving funding to the court and ensuring to the court that the court will be protected. The court has to withstand this. If the court cannot take these hard cases, these hard kind of inverted commas, politicized, if you will, issues and political issues, it's a joke. You know, it cannot continue. So we have to see support. Back with the Permanent Court of International Justice, back at the very early cases, about 1923, 1924, I think it's quite telling, one of the very first cases that came before the Permanent Court of International Justice, I think the second case was the Mavro Matis Palestine Concessions case. And this is a case at the time where a Greek individual and Greece was taking a case on behalf of this individual who had been denied concessions under the Palestine Mandate by the British administration at the time. And this case came before the Permanent Court of International Justice. And at the time, Britain was a massive, massive superpower. And if this case hadn't gone ahead, it would have crippled the credibility of the court. And it showed that the court was able to take the hard cases. And the court ruled against Great Britain at the time. And this was very significant for the success of that court and its successor court, the International Court of Justice. And we need to see similar cases being tried at the International Criminal Court. We have to take the big powers. We have to be able to take cases holding the United soldiers from the United States to account for their atrocities and their implication in war crimes and crimes against and crimes against humanity in Afghanistan. And similarly for Israeli soldiers who are carrying out atrocities in the state of Palestine. And the state of Palestine has submitted these communications and the situation to the International Criminal Court. And we need to see the International Criminal Court withstand these attacks and to really stand up and show that this is a court that not only tried these cases, but this is a court that will stand the test of time for other situations, and that this will be a court that in 100 years will be looking back and saying, okay, that was the case. That was the case where the court stood up and showed its mettle and was able to withstand massive political pressure, just like the Permanent Court of International Justice did over nearly 100 years ago.
Yeah,
so this is incredibly, this is very important.
Well, we're all waiting for that Nuremberg moment. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dr. Susan Power. Susan's head of the Legal Research and Advocacy Department of Al-Haq, a Palestinian human rights NGO based in Ramallah. I'm looking, Susan, at the website, actually, the Al-Haq. It's alhaq.org right now. And it's not just the International Criminal Court. As you mentioned, other human rights organizations are being intimidated and harried. I'm looking at a story on your website right now about Human Rights Watch Director Omar Shakir, and he's they're getting ready to give him the boot out of the country as well. So there seems to be fewer and fewer left on the ground in Palestine to witness what's going on.
Absolutely, and this is all part of the shrinking space which we're seeing at the moment. There have been, in the last week, two of these types of attacks on human rights advocates, and this second one on Omar Shakir, but also Omar Barghouti was prevented from and denied entry into the United States. And now we see that Omar Shakir has been has a deportation order. And the two incidents are quite different. I think Omar Shakir, the director of Human Rights Watch, his actual human rights work in terms of his business and human rights work, looking at the legal frameworks and holding businesses accountable for human rights violations in the occupied territory and ensuring that they comply with the UN guiding principles on business and human rights, all operating within an international law framework and highlighting these different violations of human rights carried out by businesses in the occupied territory, that his work in Human Rights Watch has been targeted now. And I think the the dangerous thing here is the Israeli court is now, because there is the boycott, the anti-boycott legislation. So the Israeli court is now trying to equate the boycott, divest and sanction movement, also with the human rights work and the normal human rights work of human rights NGOs, in ensuring that states comply with.
You have 1 minute.
Human rights, the United Nations human rights treaty system, and all of this has been put together under the same framework.
Well, Susan, Susan, I have to cut in because I've just got a sound warning that we've only got 1 minute left of this phone card that I've used to call you up. In the last 45 seconds we have, Susan, last night I saw Benjamin Netanyahu on TV saying that he was going to name settlements on the Golan Heights after Donald J. Trump. What's your reaction to that statement?
I think it's a painful statement to listen to. I just think the Palestinian population should not have to face any more humiliation than what's already been served over the last 70 years.
Please press the start key to redial the last dialed number or enter the phone number you wish to reach and press pound.
Well, I don't know if you can still hear me, Susan, but thanks for coming on. We've just been cut off talking from Ramallah. And boy, that it's so expensive to call Palestine the territories there. And of course, that's because Israel controls their telecommunication system. That was a phone card that I just burned through in no time. I could have talked to Australia for 3 hours for what I just paid for that. Thanks to Susan. Go to Al-Haq. That's alhaq.org to see more of the work that they're doing. I'm going to take a brief break and Janine will be straight up with this week's Left Coast Events Bulletin. Stick around for that.
This is David Rovics and I will be listening to Guerrilla Radio in its new time slot at 1 p.m. on Wednesdays. I need to write this down. CFMU 101.9 in Victoria.
FM.
101.9 FM in Victoria.
Okay.
This is David Rovics and I will be listening to Guerrilla Radio in its new time slot at 1 p.m. on Wednesdays on 101.9 FM CFUV in Victoria.
Listen to Guerrilla Radio every Thursday at 11 a.m. right here at CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
Tonight, Thursday, in defense of housing, a book discussion in Vancouver at the People's Co-op Bookstore. The book is written by David Madden and Peter Marcius, and the event starts at 7:30, and admission is free at 1391 Commercial Drive. In Victoria, Eco Fashion Week starts on April 25th. Aimed at creating awareness on sustainable fashion, ethical fashion, and fair trade, and giving eco-fashion designers a voice and a platform to showcase their creative work. So this starts on April 25th and goes all the way to April 27th. It's on display, I guess, at St. Andrew's Presbyterian Church, 680 Courtney Street in Victoria. Also in Victoria, community organizing potluck at the Downtown Community Center for people involved in climate justice organizing, learning about what other groups are working on, and exchanging ideas. 5:30 till 8 or 10 at the Downtown Community Center. 5:30 till 8. International Day of Mourning on Friday, Camosun College. Every day, workers suffer from work-related injuries and diseases. The theme this year for International Day of Mourning is One is Too Many, No One Should Die on the Job. Join the Victoria Labour Council and QP 2081 to remember those who are gone and continue to fight for those who are still here. Camosun College, Friday, 10:30 till 11:30. Hands off the Sioux Hills, picket line and rally rally at the Esquimalt United Church on April 26th at 5 p.m., where Premier John Horgan is presenting as a keynote speaker at a $100 a plate fundraiser. Anyone concerned about what's going on in the Souk Hills and wants to know, wants transparency, drawing attention to the Premier and his environmental record, and anybody interested in learning more or speaking their piece can join outside the event Friday 5 till 7, 500 Admirals Road. Friday in Vancouver, Hands Off Venezuela, Yemen, and Syria. A rally at the Vancouver Art Gallery starting at 5. This weekend, a gentleman called Bayou Akomolafe. The times are urgent. Let us slow down. This is an author, speaker, lecturer, renegade academic, ethno-psychotherapeutic researcher, globally recognized for his poetic, unconventional, and counterintuitive take on the global crisis, civic action, and social change. It will be presenting a series of different workshops Friday at First Met in Victoria, 7 till 9, regarding why we're so lonely, how do we talk to people and think about people on the other side of our political preferences. And then on the weekend, Saturday and Sunday, Making Sanctuary in Earnest Times, a two-day workshop. So I would suggest going online to find out about Bayou Akomolafe in Victoria this weekend. Friday in Vancouver, Digital Debt Empire, Against Debt's Digital Empire, the second public panel looking at the global context of debt regimes and debt resistance. Panel discussion at SFU Woodward's, Friday, 7 o'clock, 149 West Hastings Street. On Saturday, Tree Love Town Hall at the Gardens, the Horticultural Center for the Pacific, 505 Quail Road, calling all tree lovers, land defenders, and concerned citizens, particularly regarding the last of the Gary Oak Forests. There is a full panel involving all kinds of people speaking about this, and if you're interested in knowing more and getting involved, the doors open at 6:30 p.m. on Saturday. On Saturday in Vancouver, the Vancouver Tenants Union General Meeting and two-year anniversary at the Carnegie Community Center, 401 Main Street, 5:30 to 8:30. You can meet fellow tenants, learn about your rights as tenants, and strategize. Earth Strike Vancouver, halfway Earth Day protest, halfway between Earth Day and May Day, setting the stage for future mass actions in Vancouver at Victory Square, Saturday 2 till 5. There will be a rally this weekend. On Monday in Vancouver, a talk about how storms impact the coasts with Dr. David Atkinson from the Department of Geography. April 29th, 7:30 till 9, Fraser Building at UVic. Meatless Monday launch in Victoria next Monday. This is the result of student organizing, youth organizing, and the CRD is offering some support. I know the mayor is in support of this event. This is the first event, and the hope is that the CRD Commons Room will be full 5:30 till 7 on Monday. Bring a meatless meal that would also hopefully include no dairy, because that actually is connected to meat, and for a kickoff potluck that hopefully will continue into the future, April 29th, 5:30. Eco-grief, how to unlock the wisdom of our emotions and open to purpose. On Tuesday, April 30th, at the Zero Waste Emporium, worrying about the planet can fill you with despair. Yeah, no kidding. How do we not get crushed by the magnitude of environmental collapse and devastation? Sliding scale $15 to $20 at 1728 Douglas Street, workshopping and chatting and interactive workshops Tuesday, April 30th, starting at 7:30. And then Metamorphosis, open cinema screening in Victoria. Filmmaker Nova Ami and Velcro Ripper produced this film, bearing witness to a moment of profound change, the loss of one world and the birth of another. May 1st, starting at 7 at the Flux Media Gallery, 821 Fort Street, $10 suggested donation. Doors open at 6. And then finally, it's May Day. next week, and there is a big event, System Change for Workers and the Planet, a celebration of Victoria's social activists featuring drinks, music, and prizes at the Victoria Event Center. Victoria is home to a number of activists and organizers dedicating their efforts to the cause of labor, decolonization, the environment, and a variety of struggles against the effects of capitalism. And the first ever Victoria Socialist Awards ceremony will be held. Congratulations, Chris, to you for being recognized at this event and all the work that you've done these many, many years with Guerrilla Radio. Admission is by donation. Everybody's welcome. May 1st at the Victoria Event Center on May Day, International Workers' Day, starting at 7 o'clock. That's all I got for this week. Thanks, Chris.
Well, and thank you, Janine. I'm going to take another brief break. And when I come back, I'll be joined by Max C. Forte. We'll talk about empire, democracy, and Julian Assange. Stick around for that.
Long years ago, we made a tryst with destiny. Now the time comes when we shall redeem our pledge, not wholly or in full measure, but very substantially. At the stroke of the midnight hour, when the world sleeps,
ambitious men who time proved to be thieves. But years went by and nothing came. New flag, new name, same old game. Where the lucky laugh and the poor endure, having lost the will to fight again. Well, I remember when we were young and hope was strong, and we had waited long to hear the midnight bell that would dispel when we would bleed, cause we believed freedom was in reach of those who seized the day. But freedom came on, faded like a dream.
Say out, shout out, for the new day dawning. But it faded like a dream in the morning.
Sing out, shout out,
for the new day dawning. But it faded like a dream.
Sing out, shout out,
for the new day dawning. But it faded like a dream in the morning.
Sing out, shout out,
for the new day dawning. But it
of a dying rage, whose anthem swept across this land, proclaiming a new day. Yeah. And we waited patiently for the elusive decree. We'd rub away the scars we bore and set our voices free. But the years were on and nothing came. Tyrants just bore different names, while the official line promised brighter times. We knew all things remained the same. Of the liberator, not the henchman. People's vanguard, propaganda ministry, freedom fighters filling the ranks of the secret police, while the tale of the times told in obituary lines. We offer our resistance with these humble rhymes.
Sing out, shout out, your dream never dies.
Our people unite.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio, Kobo Town there behind me. Well, April 11th, a date that will live for many in infamy, Ecuador's president, Lenin Moreno, delivered from its embassy in London into the hands of the British government political asylee and WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange. Miles of newsprint and terabytes of misinformation has been produced regarding Assange and the nature of the case manufactured against him. But at its heart are some basic facts vital for both his just treatment and the future fairness of the planet the rest of us have to inhabit. Dr. Maximilian C. Forte is a scholar, educator, author, and creator of the Zero Anthropology Project, a Canadian anthropological approach to the study of empire and the human condition. It's website is zeroanthropology.net. Max Forte teaches full-time in anthropology and sociology at Concordia University in Montreal and also publishes the New Imperialism series, which features research by students in his advanced seminar in the field and his own research. Max is too a past finalist for the Quebec Writers Federation Mavis Gallant Prize for Nonfiction, and his book titles include Ruins of Absence, Presence of Caribs, Post-Colonial Representations of Aboriginal in Trinidad and Tobago, and Slouching Towards CERT, NATO's War on Libya and Africa. Welcome to the program, Max.
Thank you for having me, Chris. It's a real pleasure.
Well, it's my pleasure, of course. Now, Max, in your recent article, The WikiLeaks Case, Democracy Dies in Empire, you first attempt to tie together, quote, into one coherent explanation, the avalanche of news reports that have washed over the globe since the abduction of Julian Assange. Well, Max, I got to say, how's that going so far, and what does the Assange case tell us?
Well, it's a great deal, but really what's at stake, I think, I would have to say, is the meaning and reality of our citizenship. You know, to what does our citizenship actually amount? To what do we have a right as citizens? You know, how can we exercise citizenship in the absence of information and knowledge about our system of government, about those who presume to govern us? So what I think is at stake is the legitimacy also of the governing system, primarily the fact that it seems to have lost all legitimacy, and it knows it. And that puts us in a very dangerous phase, because we're dealing with states that are guilty of trying to conceal their crimes. And that is the real obstruction of justice that exists in Washington, not this stuff cooked up by the Democrats and the media and so forth that are designed more to distract people. For example, the obstruction of justice that we're dealing with, the one that has happened in the time that WikiLeaks has become prominent, begins with George W. Bush's administration plowing the U.S. into Iraq and Afghanistan, committing torture, committing war crimes, then covering up those crimes. That was followed by Obama's administration, which failed to prosecute Bush administration officials, committed even more war crimes itself, and cracked down on whistleblowers to an unprecedented level. And now we have Donald Trump maliciously turning on WikiLeaks after praising it endlessly during his electoral campaign. He's engaged in the final act of punishing those who reveal the truth. And that is really the only obstruction of justice that should concern us.
Well, and, you know, more than a Martin Niemöller moment, the, you know, first they came for the Jews, this idea that crimes that are left unaddressed, like those that you mentioned of George Bush, only magnify over the course of time until we get a creature like Mr. Trump and the kind of, who knows how far he's going to take his excess of authority.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what we're looking at right now, and we're already seeing the early signs of it. This isn't just, you know, hyperbole said for dramatic effect to stir up your listeners. But we're already seeing clear signs that the prosecution of Julian Assange is going to be a political prosecution, which makes him a political prisoner. You see it, for example, in the way he was stripped of his right as an asylee in the Ecuadorian embassy. There was no review, no appeal. It was done as a kind of last-minute decision that it was announced. The procedures that exist under Ecuadorian law were not followed. He was just expelled. You can't also strip an asylee, of their rights as an asylee, just, you know, for political reasons. In addition, his citizenship was suspended, which actually has no meaning under the Ecuadorian constitution, according to those who've studied it. So that's step number one. Step number two, he's brought into a court in Britain to begin a hearing on having, some, you know, skipped a bail hearing. And the judge that confronts him, I believe his name is Michael Snow, one of the first things he says to Assange is that he's a narcissist.
Right.
You know, I mean, first of all, the judge is a judge, not a psychoanalyst. Secondly, as far as I know, that was the first time they had ever met. So even if you were a psychoanalyst, you don't jump to that conclusion, you know, the first thing you meet a person. Secondly, it's irrelevant to the trial. It's meant to personalize, demonize, and vilify. It's actually slander. But more than that, he then added, we now know, a line that was intended, I think, to somehow bait Julian Assange. He told Assange, listen, why don't you just go across to the U.S. now and get this case over and done with, and then you can get on with your life. Because, you know, the charge is a relatively minor one, this thing of having helped, presumably, Chelsea Manning to hack into another account on the computer. But we know full well that the United States has announced that there's an ongoing criminal investigation of Julian Assange, and that more charges are pending. Yeah. So that once he arrives in the United States, a whole bunch of other charges that we haven't heard yet will materialize. And the judge knows this because he's not a stupid person. So it's a deliberate attempt to place Assange in jeopardy. For the past 2 weeks that he's been in jail, he's been denied access to his lawyers. That is only happening, I think, either today or tomorrow. For the first time, he'll be able to meet them. His case goes back to court next week on May 2nd. Mm-hmm. So not exactly a lot of time to prepare. He's being kept in isolation, he's denied contact with the outside world, and so forth. So there's already a great deal to be concerned about. I don't think it's going to be a fair trial, and I think we know that the outcome is already being predetermined.
Well, I spoke with John Helmer, a journalist who's done a lot of work in Russia over these over many long years at Dances with Bears. We were talking about the Assange case, and I had put forward that, well, maybe getting arrested, being taken out of the Ecuadorian embassy was a good thing in one sense for Assange, because he would get medical treatment, because there was medical and especially dental treatment that he couldn't get, and he was in very poor health. I said, well, he'll get that in Belmarsh, because the prison, the BRITMO, as it's not so fondly referred to as well, I mean, because they are bound by law, one would expect, to provide the basics of life for the people that they incarcerate. That's an international norm. And yet, as you mentioned, he not only was he being denied access from visitors and from his legal team, but also from medical personnel. We understand now that that's happening, and also it might have something to do with the fact that it's reported that the UN Special Rapporteur on Privacy is at the prison today visiting with Assange. He was scheduled to go visit him at the embassy in the days just following his abduction. What do you think, Max, this says about the British legal system? If they're willing to bend on things like providing the necessities of life to their prisoners, can Assange reasonably expect any kind of fair treatment in a British court when it comes to the extradition warrant against him?
Well, my expectation is that it won't be a fair trial. It hasn't begun in a fair manner to begin with. It hasn't even begun in a professional manner from that point of view. I don't know what training is required to become a judge in the United Kingdom. You would have thought that it would be a serious amount of training, and we don't see that on display so far. But, you know, we already know something. That we know that the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention almost 3 years ago declared that the various forms of deprivation of liberty to which Julian Assange had been subjected constituted a form of arbitrary detention, mm-hmm. and that he should be released right now. or right then, I should say, and compensated. I mean, his rights as an asylum seeker have basically been violated. And this is at a time when in the United States, a certain sector of public opinion is trying to make a lot of noise about the treatment of asylum seekers arriving on the U.S.'s southern border. Some of those same individuals turn around and refer to Assange as their property, and they can't wait to get their hands on him to make him pay for Russian meddling in the 2016 election. So, you know, surrounded on all corners by the media, by governments, by politicians, even by supposed leftists,
right.
He's not really in a good situation, and I'm not as hopeful as I was even just a couple of weeks ago that there could be a positive outcome. I do agree with you that, you know, in theory, being no longer being confined to the Ecuadorian embassy should have allowed him things such as access to health care and so forth. The staff of the embassy was treating him badly. That situation was really not sustainable forever, and it wasn't meant to be. I mean, he was meant to travel to Ecuador and take up residence there, and the UK did everything possible to deny him that.
Well, and in your article, and again, I've got it up at my website, gorillaradioblogspot.com. You think I know it by now. And the article we're ostensibly talking about, the WikiLeaks case, Democracy Dies in Empire, that you have up at your site, zeroanthropology.net. It starts off with, a view. I mean, you're getting your news, as I do now, through RT, the Russian news station, or all news station, or Russian-sponsored anyway. But you talk about the kind of coverage Assange has gotten in the press. I mean, I would be amazed that the press could turn on one of its own the way it has. But then I remember in 2003 when the Palestine Hotel in Baghdad was shelled, killing a number of journalists. It was obvious that they were targeted for being journalists, as other journalists were trying to cover that that invasion at the time. That, you know, no journalist seemed to stand forward and speak the outrage in that instance. Well, what's your take, though, on the media and its role in all and the pillaring of Assange?
Yeah, well, they certainly are complicit with the state. I was thinking of how Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, declared Assange. It was either last year or the year before. Declared WikiLeaks, sorry, to be a non-state,
right,
hostile intelligence service. Well, the U.S. media, for the most part, is the opposite of that. It's a pro-state, very friendly, you might say counterintelligence service. In other words, they do everything possible to cover up the kinds of things that people like Chelsea Manning and Julian Assange have been making public, exposing war crimes and so on. For the most part, that's been true. There are occasional exceptions as well. But the media has certainly turned on Assange after having used him, just like Donald Trump turned on WikiLeaks after having found great value and great use in the materials that it was publishing. And there can be a lot of reasons for that. There can be nationalistic ones, driven by this sort of hysteria that exists in the United States and to some extent in Canada about, you know, Russian meddling. The Russians are this big bogeyman now. And there's a nationalistic reason, seeing Assange as somehow being linked with the Russians as if he's, you know, their agent, which he isn't. There are professional reasons, reasons of professional jealousy, that WikiLeaks is making leaps and strides where they are not, and in fact, you know, being able to publish these things because WikiLeaks empowered them to do so. So there's all sorts of, and you know, a lot of journalists in the United States also want to dispute whether Assange is a journalist.
Right.
And Assange is many things, it's true. He operates on many different platforms. There are many different facets to his work. He's a publisher, he's an analyst, He's an author of several books. And he also is a journalist in the sense that he documents and covers what was previously unknown, brings it to light for the public, contextualizes it, analyzes it, explains it. You know, some of the materials that WikiLeaks has been releasing is incredibly complicated, sometimes, you know, technically complicated, like the CIA Vault 7 materials. Mm-hmm. Well, if you go to WikiLeaks.org, you see articles for every release from Vault 7 being explained by Assange. This is what this material does. This is why it was created. This is how it can be used, and so forth. So there's no doubt that he does journalism. He doesn't work for a media house. That's the only thing that can be said. You know, and that's, I don't think, a valid definition of journalism.
Well, and, well, he's a publisher, and nobody says the Washington Post doesn't do journalist because its owner, Jeff Bezos, its publisher, didn't go to Columbia. He's not a recognized journalist. But what about the idea, Max, and as we saw with the revelations of Britain's Integrity Initiative, that the press and the Washington Post has a long history of this, is intertwined with various intelligence agencies, both in this side of the Atlantic and the other.
Yeah, no, that's correct. And that's quite sad. It was the Washington Post, which back in 2010 was outlining the size of the national security state in the United States, you know, how it ballooned to a proportion that most people can't even imagine. Something like 1,200 government organizations, 1,900 private companies working on counterterrorism programs, intelligence, and so on, in 10,000 locations across the U.S., employing around 900,000 people. So that's 1.5 times as many people who live in Washington, D.C. itself, who have top secret security clearances. The Washington Post gave us that information, but it's also the same Washington Post whose correspondent in Iraq, David Finkel, was embedded with the very unit, the very helicopter unit that we see featured in the collateral murder video that was released by WikiLeaks, that was aware of war crimes that were committed and covered them up, said absolutely nothing about them. We would not have known about it from a Washington Post correspondent who was on the scene. We only knew about it because Chelsea Manning released that material to WikiLeaks. So, it tells us a great deal about the state of our media and who you can really turn to for support as a citizen seeking information about the truth of your government's dealings that you pay for as a citizen and that are done in your name as a citizen.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dr. Maximilian C. Forte. Max is a scholar, an educator, author, and creator of the Zero Anthropology Project. That's a Canadian anthropological approach to the study of empire and the human condition. You can find their website, zeroanthropology.net, where his work and the work of his collaborators is featured. And a great website it is too, Mac. Max, I'm looking at another article penned, Julian Assange, Political Prisoner, A Dark Day for Citizenship. You know, Max, I was just speaking with Susan Power in Ramallah and in Palestine, and she... she's a jurist, an international lawyer, and we were talking about basically impunity and the total abandonment by so many of international law. And in your article, you talk a little bit, in this article, A Dark Day for Citizenship, you talk about especially Theresa May's intoned statement that became the marching meme for the Tory party, nobody is above the law. What does that mean in this context where nobody, at least in power, seems to be obeying it?
No, that's exactly right. It's an empty statement, and I can't imagine there are many people in the UK who would have been impressed with it, because they know, a great many, if not the majority, know that it's simply not true. If it were true, Tony Blair would be serving time in prison for war crimes, for taking Britain into a war against Iraq, a country that had never threatened Britain, that never attacked Britain, that possessed no weapons of mass destruction, that was not any kind of immediate threat. He lied. His intelligence services lied. The result of the war was hundreds of thousands killed, millions displaced. You know, if no one was above the law, Tony Blair would be in prison, and a great many others for that matter. That is just one example. So I think most people, at least intuitively, know not to take such statements seriously. We already know that they're not true, that there are different scales of justice for different classes in society. And it's a kind of disturbing statement. It's a very, very disturbing statement on another level. Assange exposed war crimes. Manning exposed war crimes. It's the legal duty of somebody like Manning to have exposed those war crimes. There are several manuals and documents in the U.S. Army that state strictly, you know, in very clear language, you're not required to follow an unlawful order. And if you see anything being done that is a violation of the law, it is your responsibility to make it known. To cover it up is an obstruction of justice. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine how anyone believes that Assange should be prosecuted for the act of exposing war crimes. As Ray McGovern put it recently, there is no good counter-argument to exposing war crimes. There's no good argument you can make against it.
Well, and this is why I suppose that the American government is so desperate to find some other legal hook to hang their case and hang Julian Assange by.
Yeah, absolutely. It wants the ability to commit actual war crimes, mm-hmm. and to have as a response from the public either silence or applause. Those are the only two permissible responses. What Assange has been doing is obviously the response that is not permitted, and they're going after him for it. And this is what the prosecution is. It's a political prosecution, and it tells us something about the society we live in North America, about the rule of law, about justice, about the nature of our citizenship, about freedom of speech, and so forth. And everybody ought to be paying attention,
right.
Because it's not just Assange. It might be Assange today, but there are also other journalists that we, you know, you could be the target, Chris. I could be the target as an academic. All sorts of academics could be a target. So it's when we're talking about freedom of speech and our rights as citizens that are imperiled by acts such as these, we all ought to be paying attention.
Well, it may sound corny, but yeah, we are all Julian Assange. You end your article, Max, not the one we've been talking about mostly, but the previous Julian Assange, political prisoner, a dark day for all of us. You end it by saying Assange will end his days as a free man, continuing his work, wealthy and celebrated. I hope that that's true for you. Do you still?
Me too, but since I've written that, I've become very pessimistic.
You changed your mind, yeah? Well,
yeah.
You know, I'll stick with that, Max, because I think that it may take longer to happen, but when we look at somebody like Nelson Mandela, I mean, I hope it doesn't take 27 years for Julian Assange, but I think that the truth will out and justice, as Martin Luther King said, that the arc of justice, the arc of history bends towards justice. I'm hoping that is the case here. Max, thanks a lot for coming on the show today. Again, Max's website, zeroanthropology.net. Thanks for coming on and talking to us, eh?
Oh, thank you very much. It was a great pleasure for me.
Well, until the next time. And I want to thank Susan Power and Janine Bancroft as well, and all the good people that keep the wheels spinning week in and week out up here. There's great programming coming, you know that. But that's all I've got for this week. Until the next time.
Times on an obituary lines, we offer our resistance with these humble rhymes.
Sing out, shout out, your dream never dies.
Our people united, no bully can brutalize.
Sing